world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
According to science, some of the best news you could ever hear if there had been an accident and a loved one was in the hospital would be when the doctor came out after you'd been waiting for hours, there'd been a terrible injury, and the doctor would say, "You know, I almost saved him." Now, could you imagine the reaction of somebody who, in hearing such news as that, would say, "Oh, thank you so much, Doc. That's the best news I've ever heard," and congratulate the doctor, "You almost saved him," you say, and then go away happy? No, I don't think so. The vast difference between life and death is so enormous and is so absolutely total and is such a vast, gaping maw across which there is no bridge known to man that it would be some of the most shocking and heart-rending news you could ever get. But you know, science comes along and says, we almost created life in a test tube. And so millions of people think science can now create life. So the origin of life is a big question for science. It's something that has a lot of theologians, and especially the theologically inclined layman, on the run, because most people, though they have a just-in-case religion, they want to make sure and be on God's right side, you know, you and me, Lord, and someone up there likes you and all that type of thing, just in case something happens, like a personal tragedy, flood, fire, hail, and storm, whether maybe an accident or near death, or maybe just times of mental distress and emotional upset. Matter of fact, many people reason around that you need a God, that you need to have the idea of a God because it helps you. You're more of a balanced mental type, and you don't have all the hang-ups that many other people do if you can just believe in there being a God. But is there really a God? And if there is, can you prove it? Now, you can't see God, but then you can't see air, and you can believe in air. You can't see God, but then you can't see gravity, and you surely believe in gravity. There are a lot of things you can't see that you believe in with all your being that actually act upon you as a force or an energy that even holds you to this earth, but you don't go around in a quandary and all perplexed and say, "I just can't figure this business of gravity out," but you really can't. Nobody ever really has. Now, you know, because Newton put a name to it doesn't mean that it became the property of science. Because a man comes along and comes up with a theory, and a lot of other people agree, and they finally put a label upon it, usually always using a Greek or a Latin word, doesn't mean that science suddenly reaches up here and takes this giant principle and packages it all up and says, "We own it. It's ours." Science may have defined gravity, but it certainly did not create it, and more importantly, it does not sustain it. So you believe in a lot of things you can't see. You really do. But it seems to be so difficult for people to accept the idea of there being an all-wise, divine, creator being who literally created the heavens and the earth. So we've had some of the most beleaguered and frustrated types of citizens these many decades, especially since Darwinian ideas came along, running thither and hither and thither and yon, wherever those places are, trying to come up with ideas about how the entirety of this awesome universe of ours, the solar system, the earth, and the vast complexity of interdependent life forms upon it came to be. One of the most beautiful little pieces of literature that I have read in a long time, this ought to be in classrooms, no it shouldn't, but this is the way I would imagine it would be read in classrooms, appeared in a newspaper down in Tallahassee, Florida not so long ago. It was an attempt to explain the origin of life on the earth, and it went something like this. Life presumably began on earth 2 to 3 billion years ago. For hundreds of millions of years before, this planet had circled the burning sun, utterly devoid of any living thing. To be sure, it pulsed with powerful physical forces. Great winds blew mightily, or soft breezes caressed stony mountains. Rains fell, and volcanoes and earthquakes rent the earth. Seas swelled and diminished. Continents rose up and eroded. Lightning darted and thunder rolled, and gorgeous sunsets painted young skies. But there was nothing living to bear witness. Sounds like the beginning of a great story. And that's what it is. It's a great story. Didn't happen that way, but that's what they presuppose. It goes on to say, then by scientific theory, a spark of life was struck. Now, if a theologian comes along and says, in the beginning, God created, atheists, skeptics, other doubters of whatever ilk will say, now, wait a minute, you can't say that because you can't prove there is a God because you can't see God, and where did you get God, and who created God? But science comes along, not all science, but some science does, and says in the beginning was the hydrogen atom. And one day it exploded, and then eventually all this other stuff I read, by scientific theory, a spark of life was struck. A spark of life was struck. Now, what does that do to our vanity? You know, a lot of Oriental religions believe that they came from insects and are going back that way. But most people in the Western world of Christianity, at least as it's called, believe in the idea of the God of the Bible and of the Jesus Christ of Nazareth of the New Testament. How can you accept both the idea, then, of a gradual evolutionary process and the belief in the Bible? There's only one way you can do that. And that's more difficult than a politician sitting on the middle of the fence and keeping an ear to the ground on both sides at the same time, and some of them try to get themselves in that kind of a position. The only way I can figure that a person could believe something like that is that he's got to accept a kind of a watered-down Bible. He believes that the Bible is a book that is largely myth, a little sprinkling of tribalism and superstition and various taboos and whatnot, a certain smattering of history, a lot of expectant and very optimistic preaching about the way things ought to be, maybe a few attempts at ancient sages to bring about dynamic social revolution by warning the existing government and the present status quo or the establishment of the ancient Hebrew nation the way they were going and this and that, plus the life story of Christ. They've got to take some idea there that is somewhere in between that they can say, I'm a Christian, meaning they believe in the traditional idea of there being a God, that that God has a son whose name is Christ, who died to save the world, who was resurrected, but with lots of reservations. Some of those reservations being, but I don't think I need to obey God, and I don't need to think that I really need to study the Bible to understand it, and I certainly don't want to be caught believing things like Daniel in the lion's den and Noah in the ark and really a whole global flood, in spite of the fact that the most important rocks we see all around us, in numbers at least, the largest numbers, are sedimentary, water deposited. But we don't want to be caught in a public situation making any such embarrassing admissions that, well, yes, I believe what it says in the book of Genesis. People don't want to be caught out of doors with a Bible in their hands. You don't want to be caught on a public conveyance reading one, underlining it, looking like you're really studying it, because people will think that you're absolutely off your rocker. We're a Bible-selling, Bible-oriented society in one way. There are Bibles all around. You can go down and look in the motel top drawer, and you'll see the Bible there. Maybe a Bible society placed it there, the Gideons or somebody. But you won't see too many people explaining it one to the other, or studying it, reading it, pondering it, looking into it. So here is the theory for the beginning of life, the way evolutionary science tells it. Then by scientific theory, a spark of life was struck. Primitive bits of life appeared out of chemical mixtures. They lived, grew, and produced new generations. So we don't have much of an opinion of ourselves. Some Orientals claim they came from insects and are going back to that. We think we came from nothing, from lovesick amoeba, or from all kinds of things. Now, let's have a little contest here right away. You pick the most childish idea you can come up with. I'll give you a few ideas. You know, bathrobe fluff, navel lint, or rug fuzz, anything you want to come up with as to being your own private theory about the origin of life.
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, and it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
There is no dearth of speculations as to how life began, according to a Dr. Sidney W. Fox, who is director of the Oceanographic Institute and professor of chemistry at the Florida State University. As a matter of fact, the more you look into it, you think that there are just about as many theories as there are people around to expound those theories. That's why I said you ought to come up with one of your own. Now, what have you come up with? You could pick a real weird idea, linoleum, something. But somewhere, somehow, where was the spark of life struck that brought about the original little bit of life that gradually evolved into what we know today? So in the way of thinking of these people, in one famous experiment, they came up with the idea the Earth's original atmosphere contained marsh gas. I think that was even before there were any marshes, because it seems to me, to get marsh gas, you got to have a marsh, but I lost myself there somewhere. They're talking about the origin of life, and they say it existed as marsh gas without marshes. Ammonia, hydrogen, and water vapor. Now the question is, where did these come from? Well, they say ultraviolet light from the sun or lightning might have supplied the energy to make chemicals in the atmosphere react and build up fairly simple organic compounds, including amino acids. But the ideas for the origin of life are the following. The first one is the hot pool theory. And that theory proposes that in tracing biological history back to the first living thing, scientists believe that aeons ago a great number of organic compounds existed in warm waters on the Earth, or possibly a kind of a noxious mixture of methane and ammonia and some of these other things. Although, and I'm quoting this from a newspaper, although the exact process nature used billions of years ago may never be known, the recent discoveries offer ever-increasing evidence. Now get yourself on this one, because this hot pool theory, it says, they're getting ever-increasing evidence on this theory that man's family tree may have sprung from a hot pool of chemicals on the primeval Earth. And it looks to me like today we're going about the business of trying to get the Earth back to being nothing but a hot pool of chemicals. We're all going to dive in and say, here goes nothing, and pollute ourselves off the face of the Earth anyhow. Now, what would you think would be the absolute opposite of that? See how close you came on some of your ideas about where life might have come from. Maybe you thought in the bark of a rubber tree. Well, no, you can't do that, see, because they made that mistake. They said marsh gas without having marshes. You had to start with something which was not life. So the exact opposite of that is this. That is the theory of, you guessed it, intense cold. The exact opposite of the hot pool. Now, the intense cold might have started life on Earth. According to a new theory proposed by a team of California researchers, the earliest building blocks of materials of life might have rained down in hailstones, also formed on the Earth's surface. Such processes occurred more than 3 trillion years ago, when no life existed on our planet. After the freezings had formed the first building blocks of proteins and nucleic acids and clicked them into the earliest self-reproducing things like viruses, it says there was no more formation of life out of non-life. Eventually the cold passed away and warmer times came. Isn't that great? It makes great scientific kind of language too, isn't it? More or less like the primer. It's almost like by the shores of Gitche Gumee, you know, they gave me all that stuff way back when they used to give you Hiawatha. They made us poor kids recite that over and over again. Now, if you could imagine the next theory, you're probably way ahead of me. I'll bet you guessed that the next theory would sure enough be a cross between the two. That's exactly what it is. It is the hot and the cold theory. A researcher at the Salk Institute of Biological Studies, Dr. James P. Ferris, said his work indicates that the synthesis of life from chemicals believed to have been present in the primordial ocean could have involved temperatures which were alternately warm and freezing. This view varies with most others, which are based on a system involving only high temperatures. But Dr. Ferris said that life may have come about in shallow water, subjected to sunlight at temperatures similar to those existing today. This would mean that the primordial soup would have been subject to both hot and freezing temperatures. So you've got them both. You've got the hot, the cold, and then the oscillation between the two. Now the next theory, and this sounds like a Campbell ad, but believe me, it is not. There's no payola involved. It's called the thin soup theory. A scientist says that life on Earth may have got its start in a thin soup of hydrocyanic acid, one of the deadliest poisons. Now that seems strange. It was admitted in this Washington, D.C. article. It may seem, it said, seemingly strange to you that life would develop from a substance deadly to life. Well, they're up with me there. Yeah, that seems a little strange, all right. But this was outlined in an annual report of the Carnegie Institute of Washington. The institution operates three research institutions throughout the country. The theory that living things were formed by a sequence of processes beginning with a hydrocyanic acid, also called prussic acid, was reported by Dr. Philip H. Abelson, director of the institution's geophysical laboratory. Now, he takes issue with a commonly held view that the primitive atmosphere was chiefly methane and ammonia. It's okay for scientists to take issue with it, but don't you show up with a Bible under your arm and say, I believe God created, and let one of these scientists who believes in the theory of the, maybe the coal theory, the hot theory, or some other theory, because he's going to laugh you out of the classroom, especially if you're a kid in college, and you're taking some course, or you're supposed to believe what that book says if you want to go out and work for the big oil company, and maybe you want to learn all there is to know about, let's say, stratigraphy. And about fossils, because you're going to work for an oil company and go out to try to find new oil fields. Well, brother, you better get busy and just study that course and believe what they tell you, and don't bring up all kinds of embarrassing questions about how they get around to dating these strata, because you could get laughed out of class. But this man did take issue with the commonly held view that the primitive atmosphere was chiefly methane and ammonia. If there had been, some geochemical evidence of it would remain, he said. But there is no such evidence, according to him. A more likely atmosphere, he had concluded, would be one containing carbon monoxide, nitrogen, and hydrogen. Irradiation of such a mixture would produce not amino acids, but hydrocyanic acid as a principal product. However, subsequent irradiation of hydrocyanic acid solutions, accumulated as a thin soup in the ocean, would produce the amino acids required to get life started. And I know I lost you there somewhere, but here's the picture of the thin soup idea, at any rate. Now, I don't know how close you've come to some of your own theories you might have thought of yet, but did you think of this one? And it shows you there's racism in everything. The next one is brown scum theory. And I don't know why they couldn't have called it white scum theory or something else, but they call it brown scum theory. This is from research chemists at a major chemical company. And they discovered that a poison, hydrogen cyanide, may have been, they say, the key to the origin of life. So Clifford N. Matthews, a Monsanto chemist, said recently the experiments have resulted in a new theory on the origin of proteins, the main chemical substance in all life on Earth. Another scientist and he both got together, said they'd mixed methane and ammonia, then they shot electricity through this gaseous mixture for about 24 hours, The electricity was representative of the high energy believed to abound in primitive Earth. The eventual result was a black solid. They had a kind of a mixture of chemicals, and they bombarded it, and eventually it was a black solid. I remember lots of things we've left lying around in old jars and bottles that after a length of time out of doors became a black solid. But I never did suspect that might have created life in there or something, but that's what they got. It was very significant. So the eventual result was a black solid, and then we added water. Now, that sounds like a soup ad all over again. They had this black solid, and they added water, and would you believe what they got? Brown scum, which they think once covered the whole of the earth. Now, we used to hear about the yellow peril back during World War II, you know, and then we got to the red menace, but, I mean, scientists talks about brown scum. So that's one of the ideas, and they said, and I quote, from this scum we apparently have emerged. From this scum we apparently have emerged. There are another couple of real funny theories, and maybe I haven't quite hit on the one you thought of yet.
Plain Truth, the International Journal of Understanding. How do Plain Truth readers benefit from its monthly format? News editor Gene Hogberg comments,
as good, as thorough as other news sources are, they cannot give a reader the real overall meaning behind events in this hectic world of ours. They can tell you what's happening, how it's happening, but not the long-term why.
Assistant to the editor Robert Kuhn discusses special features.
We make it easy for our readership to get involved. Our articles are written short, to the point, but yet at the same time bring the most sophisticated understanding of what these events and occurrences really mean.
If you're not already receiving Plain Truth, request your own prepaid subscription to this International Journal of Understanding. Plain Truth. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
You know, many a person believes that science has already replaced religion, and I can see why a lot of people would want to think that when you look at traditional religion, the dimly lit interiors of stained glass windowed churches and little old ladies and gradually diminishing congregations, about half filling the pews with a quiet 20-minute sermon that is barely enough to keep Henry off the golf course if his wife is vociferous enough about what it looks like in front of the kids. And there has been a waning of religious influence in American life over these last few years following the big revival of religion temporarily in the 1950s. Young college students, however, are getting a pretty steady diet of evolution in college classrooms, and kids do from the time of kindergarten anymore. I mean, even mathematics has a little bit of evolutionary thought. It seems to permeate and pervade every single class, no matter on what subject. There's an evolutionary concept, but they're not given both sides of the question. They don't have a textbook that on one page it presents the biblical point of view and on the next page presents the scientific or the evolutionary point of view. And I don't want anybody to make the mistake of thinking that I am saying that there is any conflict whatsoever between true science and the Bible, because there simply is not. The Bible does not purport to be a textbook on science, but the Bible does absolutely show that you can't understand science without that basic foundational building block of the understanding of where everything came from. It would save a lot of scientific ideas, a lot of scientific minds, maybe a few nightmares. But some of these ideas they have come up with about the origin of life are absolutely laughable to me, and I don't mean to make fun of any person. I'm talking now about ideas. That's why I told you that you could probably come up with something like rug fuzz, except the trouble is that may have been made from a sheep's back, and so you got something that's already living there ahead of time. But these theories are absolutely hilarious. You've got extreme cold, extreme heat. You've got a thin soup or a brown scum or a green slime. Now listen to the next one, and that is the theory that man and other living creatures of the earth may have evolved. Oh, all of these statements have the may have and the perhapses and possibles and maybes and what ifs and we suppose. May have evolved from polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea. This was the oceanographic discovery. It was offered as a theory by a Yale scientist, Dr. P.J. Wangerski. His theory was based on laboratory experiments believed to simulate seawater chemistry, giving evidence that non-living organic particles are constantly being formed on air bubbles in the sea. That is, the air bubbles attract dissolved materials. So he offered the view that this mechanism of particles adhering to the bubbles may have been an important step in the long process of evolution from chemical substances to primitive life in the sea. And if this is true, these organic blobs formed on air bubbles in the sea might be the progenitors of all life on the planet. So there's another, and it's respectable, you know. I mean, the man, it doesn't embarrass a man in science to come out with a theory like that. It doesn't embarrass him at all, because they're not asking you to vote for them. They don't have any special political axe to grind. A scientist is free to speculate. As long as he is a scientist, he is completely free to speculate. But now a theologian who would speculate, well, then he's going to get laughed at, because it's not, you don't play it by the same rules. It's a different ball game all the way around. Science can say in the beginning was the hydrogen atom. Students dutifully take notes. A theologian might say in the beginning, God. Everybody sits back and says, oh, yeah, sure. He probably believes in the rib bit and how many angels on the head of a pin, and was Daniel really in the den, and so on. And so there seems to be a certain all-pervasive anti-supernaturalistic bias which has come into its own in the modern 20th century space age, partially as a result, I think, of the ineptitude of many people in theological circles to do appropriate battle with some of the godless atheistic ideas promoted by scientists. I speak of doing battle with ideas, not people. I think because many people have given up before they started, when you find leading theologians who are supposed to know the Bible telling their audiences and telling students in colleges, I can't prove whether or not there is a God, then it's no wonder the students begin to say, well, I can't either. But, oh, yes, you can, and the Bible commands you to. In the first chapter of the book of Romans, I read this the last time, it says in verse 19, because that which may be known of God is evident to them. Now, that's the way the modern English version would read, because God has shown it to them. For the invisible things of Him, the invisible things about God, are clearly seen by the creation of the world, are clearly understood by looking at that which has been created. Even the eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. When they knew God, they glorified Him not as God. They weren't thankful, but became vain in their foolish imaginations, or in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. That's what God says of the ancient scribes and Pharisees and prophets and sages and some of those who promoted some of the earliest scientific theories of our modern age, and upon whose lives and philosophy some of the modern psychology is still based. Some of these very men of whom the Apostle Paul spoke so long ago, much of modern psychology is based on their thinking today. The Bible says you can prove it. Science says evolution is true, but we can't prove it, but we have perhapses and maybes, and you're left in a quandary. What do you do with it? Well, there are only two alternatives. Either God did create, or there is no God. That's all there is to it. Well, there are seven proofs God exists. Now, this booklet that we'll send you by return mail, free of charge, shows you these are not guesses, but factual proofs. It's not a weighty booklet. It's a very short, very brief booklet that I imagine you can read in less than 20 minutes. It's just that simple. If you're discussing religion, which oftentimes is not too good an idea, religion isn't always a very exciting subject over dinner, is it? Because it tends to get into arguments and people get a little touchy about religion. But if you want some ammunition, you're discussing whether or not there is a God with a person who is mildly skeptic or really does doubt it, an atheist or a friend of yours who just can't see the proof. I've met many people, heard of many people, who have said there can't be a God because... And then they begin to talk about Vietnam, or starvation, or accidents, or warfare, or sickness, or a loved one of theirs that was a very great person, but who died of throat cancer with seemingly no cause. And people have, well, many reservations, many doubts. They wonder whether or not there really is a God. You write for this booklet, Does God Exist? If you want some real solid proofs for further research and discussion on your own part, very tangible, easy to read, simple to understand. All you need to do to receive this booklet is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that. If you would, please, the call letters of your radio station. While you're at it, why don't you request the current number of the Plain Truth and find that there is a solution beyond human understanding. And we talk in the Plain Truth plainly even about Bible prophecy and about an ultimate solution beyond the acknowledgement of today's news media, because they simply do not acknowledge God or Bible prophecy. And that's what you will read in the Plain Truth. It is Plain Truth, straight from the shoulder, plain talk. I hope you'll write for it. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.